From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iran's nuclear technology. Is there a threat of war? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency is reporting serious concerns about Iran's ability to build an atomic bomb. There's still no evidence that it wants to, but it's working on weapons technology, and it has the fuel to build a nuclear arsenal if it chooses to do so. It's also moving more projects to a chamber under a mountain, and in Israel, there's public debate over whether it's time to attack. Is that likely? Would the U.S. become involved? Will Iran engage in diplomacy if it faces a tough new round of economic sanctions? On Reporter's Notebook later on, sexual abuse and football at Penn State University. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency reports that Iran is still working on nuclear weapons technology. Will Israel launch a preemptive strike? Should the U.S. be more assertive? Is diplomacy possible without new sanctions that might threaten Iran's central bank? On Reporter's Notebook, Penn State's football coach Joe Paterno won't face any charges, but sexual abuse by a former subordinate may have ended Paterno's storied career. First, this news update. Results from yesterday's elections in two swing states are providing mixed messages about the prospects for President Obama's reelection next year. In Ohio, Republican Governor John Kasich acknowledged today that his anti-union efforts might have been too much too soon. Michael Shear reports on politics for the New York Times. He's also chief correspondent for the Caucus blog, and is always welcome on our program. Michael Shear, good to have you.
Glad to be here.
On the ballot was the Republicans' ban on collective bargaining for public unions, and the voters threw it out.
Right, and you know, the Democrats nationally are trying to make a big deal out of that result, saying that the implications go beyond just Ohio and go beyond just the issue of labor in that state, and rather reflect a kind of energized Democratic base, a kind of counter narrative to the one that Republicans have been telling for the past year, you know, about a dispirited Democratic base that just isn't going to show up. So the Democrats are really counting on that, you know, to change their fortunes next year, and are hoping that this is a signal of things to come.
Was Obama's operation visible in that campaign, or was it just the unions in Ohio?
Well, it sort of depends on who you ask. The Obama people put out some documentation today suggesting that they have, in fact, been taking some of this, you know, many millions of dollars that they've been raising over the course of this year and that the president's been raising to kind of build up a network in Ohio and across the rest of the country, a network of turnout and voter registration and the like, and that this was a good test of that. The Republicans sort of, you know, doubt that a little bit, and they suggest that this was much more limited in Ohio to a particular, you know, dislike in the Ohio electorate for what Governor Kasich had done and how quickly and rapidly he had moved to kind of implement a conservative agenda, and that in fact there were many local issues at play that don't really mean much beyond the borders of that state.
Always difficult to extrapolate from local elections to national ones, but in Ohio, that's not all they did. Tell us about what happened to the public health, to the health insurance mandate. Excuse me.
Well, and that's exactly what the Republicans point to, is they say, look, you know, if the Democratic turnout machine had been as effective as the Obama folks and the Democrats would like you to believe, one would have thought that those same people who had come out on behalf of kind of the Democratic agenda would have then also voted down this healthcare mandate provision, which basically said you can't have any healthcare mandates. It was essentially perceived as a kind of anti-Obamacare, anti you know, sort of a, the other direction from the president's health care bill. But it passed wildly. So, you know, it's sort of a mixed message there. And the Republicans are saying, you know, maybe the turnout wasn't all that, you know, wasn't as broad as the Democrats would like you to believe. And it was really just focused on that one union issue.
Some pretty negative news for the president in Virginia.
Yeah, Virginia is an interesting case. You know, I reported in Virginia for nearly 20 years. You know, the Republicans made big gains in the House of Delegates. They picked up 7 or 8 seats. Their majority there is almost 2/3, I think. The state Senate had been held by Democratic hands narrowly, and it looks like the Republicans have probably won that back. It's sort of teetering on on one race that's separated at the moment by 86 votes. What that shows more than anything else is that Virginia has become, after many, many years of being a very conservative state that was always in Republican hands, it's become a 50-50 kind of state. It's become a state that's highly competitive, and if President Obama wants to keep the 13 electoral votes from that state in his column, he is going to have to spend lots of money and fight really hard.
A couple of other elections that might or might not have any impact nationally. What happened in Mississippi with the ban the abortion law?
Well, you know, this had been sort of watched closely, especially among abortion rights groups who said that this was one of those laws that went, you know, kind of far beyond the normal abortion regulation that conservatives are often pushing, and it would have not only banned pretty much all abortion, but it would have banned some forms of contraception as well by defining a fertilized human egg as a person in all the ways that matters legally. It went down big, and so you know again the Democrats point to that as you know evidence that there is a line beyond which the electorate is not willing to cross.
And we don't have much time left, but in Arizona they recalled the Senator Russell Pierce, who was the author of that very hardline immigration law in that state.
Right. And so the question really, I mean, that's going to be a big fight over the course of the next year and then even beyond is which party is able to capture the Hispanic vote and specifically on the immigration issue. Have the Republicans gone too far on that issue?
Michael Shear with The New York Times, as always, thanks for being with us. In a moment, Iran's nuclear technology. Is there a threat of war? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency has released a report expressing serious concerns that Iran is still trying to develop technology that would only be useful for nuclear weapons, and that it has enough enriched uranium to fuel a small arsenal if it were to choose to build one. Julian Borger is diplomatic correspondent for Britain's Guardian newspaper. He was in Vienna when the report was released. He's back in London now. Julian Borger, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here.
There's been much attention paid to this report, but it's your opinion, as I understand it, that it really was not all that new.
Well, it wasn't new to the major powers who it was delivered to. A lot of the information was originally given as tip-offs from some of the Western governments, from Israel. Russia and China had been briefed on the contents, and in one case where there was a former Soviet or Russian former atomic scientist who had apparently been giving lectures in Iran about implosion devices, well, the Moscow would have been well aware of him and most likely would have talked to him. So to the major powers now who have to decide how to respond, there's nothing new here.
So what do we know then, what does the public know now, about Iran's ability to build a nuclear weapon once again if it should choose to do so?
Well, what is known is that at least the IAEA and their inspectors believe there's a lot of credible evidence that up till 2003, there was a lot of work done. There was an organized weapons program in which lots of experiments were carried out. After 2003, however, the evidence is sketchier. It comes from fewer member states, and it's what does seem to have gone on, seems to have gone on a lower level, computer modeling. Now, in terms of the ability, Iran's ability to let off a nuclear detonator, nuclear device, well, they won't know, and we won't know until they test one. No matter how much computer modeling they do, the only way to know whether you've got a device that works is to test one for real.
You've said that the real concern is the accumulation of enriched uranium, which has the potential to fuel a nuclear arsenal. Elaborate on that.
Well, yes, to the extent that most of the there's an assumption that sooner or later, if the Iranians really wanted to, they could crack the weaponization problems, or the problems of getting a weapon small enough to put on a missile. The most visible and arguably the hardest part of accumulating getting a nuclear arsenal together is getting the fissile material for that arsenal. And they now have about 5 tons of low-enriched uranium, which if, and that's a big if they decided to turn that into weapons grade, and that would mean leaving the NPT and chucking out the IAEA and a lot of very serious steps. But if they took that decision, then they had enough to would have enough to make maybe 4 nuclear warheads.
So there's concern then, according to the IAEA, but nothing in the way of what you'd call a smoking gun to indicate that Iran is, in fact, working to build nuclear weapons.
No, there's nothing to indicate that that decision has been taken. There's lots of evidence that the Iranians would like to have the know-how and the materials to hand should that moment come, but nothing to suggest that there's any sense of a race to make a weapon.
At the same time, though, some of the work that's being done, as I understand it, is being moved now to a chamber that's dug under a mountain at a military base?
Yeah, this is Fordow, a facility that had been dug in secret until it was discovered and announced by President Barack Obama in 2009. Now, this isn't a secret site anymore. The IAEA does have safeguards on it. In other words, they have the right to monitor what goes on. And so there is not going to be activity there that the IAEA doesn't know about until and unless the Iranians decided to chuck out the IAEA or make a break from the NPT, and there's no sign of that happening yet.
What about the possibility that there is a parallel effort to someplace that the IAE doesn't know about?
Well, that, to a sense, in a sense, is a bigger worry, because the breakout scenario where Iran makes the decision to break from the NPT is an unlikely scenario, because it would give its enemies a month's notice before it developed weapons. What is more worrisome and more threatening is the possibility that there is this parallel program going on underground, unseen, which would mean that out of nowhere Iran would have weapons and without warning, and would arrive on the scene, on the world stage, as a nuclear weapon state without any notice.
Again, Julian Borger is diplomatic correspondent for The Guardian newspaper in Britain. Ari Shavit is columnist for Haaretz newspaper in Jerusalem. He's writing a book about the Arab-Israeli conflict to be published by Random House next year. And Ari Shavit, good to have you on our show.
Hello. Good to be here with you.
The prime minister of your country, the defense minister of your country, have indicated that they think it might well be time for a strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. And there has been so much debate, public debate, that polls show that there's now a sort of even division in Israel on that issue. How likely is it that your country might, in fact, attack Iran?
Well, there is so much here. Let me start point by point. First of all, I think that it is agreed upon all Israelis, and I think it's agreed upon most serious players in the West, that we are faced with a dire dilemma, and I would put it this way. What we don't want is the dilemma of bomb or bombing. an Iranian bomb would have catastrophic implications not only for Israel, but for the region, for every moderate Arab, and it will in fact have a terrible impact on the West, America, and Europe. Bombing, either by Israel or by others, would be very, very dramatic, with nearly catastrophic implications, perhaps even catastrophic. Therefore, what is needed is a third way. What you need is assertive diplomacy. And what this report actually proves, in a sense, this is an international document that proves that the international community has failed in dealing with Iran in diplomatic means. What we have now is a very narrow window for assertive diplomacy. If this doesn't happen during this winter, in the coming months, we might be faced with that terrible dilemma that we don't want to face.
Why would the Iranians having a bomb be so dangerous? There are those who say that the regime may be extreme, but that it's not crazy and that it would never use such a weapon against Israel or anywhere else because of the fear of retaliation.
Well, first of all, I think we are not sure that they'll be a rational player. But let's, for a moment, take the assumption that no nuclear device will go off in the Middle East in the coming decade, that the Iranians will not use their device. Even if you take this optimistic scenario, there are three or four implications to an Iranian bomb. One is dramatic proliferation of nuclear arms in the Middle East. What you're going to have to see is a nuclear Saudi Arabia, a nuclear Egypt, probably nuclear Algeria, a nuclear you-know-whom. And the result will be a multipolar nuclear system, something we've never experienced anywhere in the world before, in the most unstable region. You are going to take a risk, leave aside Israel, that has been never been taken before. You're going to have a dramatic nuclear system in the most unstable region in the world. This is dramatic. This is the first consequence. The second is the death of the NPT altogether, because the moment you're going to allow this in this region with this regime, there is no way you can stop any third world country or any small country in the New East Europe or anywhere. This is the death of the NPT, the great success of the international community in preventing a nuclear disaster since Hiroshima and Nagasaki is going to fade away.
The NPT, of course, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Go ahead.
Yes. The third implication is that you are going to have an extremist wave in the Middle East, because the moment Iran goes nuclear, it becomes the hegemonic power. It has a radical ideology, even if it's not crazy, it has a radical ideology. Therefore, all the radical forces in the Middle East are going to have a great support, and you will endanger the few remaining moderate, stable, Western-friendly regimes in the region. Therefore, an Iranian bomb, again, leave aside Israel, an Iranian bomb is a threat to any moderate Arab, and actually to Europe and the United States.
Isn't Israel, with nuclear weapons, seen as a threat by all of its Arab neighbors?
Look, I don't know that Israel is a nuclear power, but if that is the case, then Israel should get, on this issue, completely different than Israel's behavior regarding settlements and occupation. But if Israel went nuclear some years ago with some claim, then it should get an honor certificate from the international community, because it's a small country facing many enemies, went through several wars, and it never used that. So it shows that if what you're implying is true on this issue, Israel has been a mature player.
Back to Iran, how likely do you think it is that Israel, particularly with its top leaders talking this way, might in fact launch an attack against Iran?
First of all, let me, if I may, correct you. The leaders have not been talking this way. This has been media reports claiming that there has been some discussions in closed rooms. The Israeli leaders, including the two you've mentioned, have not threatened directly the use. They've not been talking about it or threatening the use of military power. What they said is what President Obama said, what President Sarkozy said, which is all options should be on the table. I think the military option, and definitely an Israeli one, is very, very bad. The way to prevent it is assertive diplomacy now.
Thank you for clarifying that. Ari Shavit, again, a columnist for the Haaretz newspaper in Jerusalem. Joe Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund. He's also a nuclear policy expert and familiar to our guests, to our audience on this program. Joe Cirincione, it's good to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be back, Warren. Thank you for having me.
No doubt you agree with Ari Shavit that an attack on Iran would be a bad idea, but what are the prospects for diplomacy at this point?
Well, it's because the military option is so bleak that people are forced to turn to diplomacy, even though the diplomatic outlook is bleak. But you hear former Israeli intelligence officials, former military leaders in Israel saying, for example, as the head of Mossad did, Meir Dagan, that an Israeli attack on Iran would be stupid. Another said it would set Israel back 100 years, would lead to a third war in the Middle East, and could tank the global economy. For all those reasons, there is no real military option with Iran. So you're forced to look at the diplomatic ones. We've had success engaging Iran in the past. For example, as in 2003, 2004, Iran actually suspended its uranium enrichment program for 18 months and sat down for talks with the Europeans. What they really wanted was to talk to the U.S., but the U.S. wasn't interested. The U.S. wasn't interested at that time. Now President Obama comes in, and he is interested. He wants to talk, but it's the Iranians who don't trust us anymore and don't prefer not to talk, and they have their own dysfunctional system with the open warfare between Ahmadinejad, the president, and the supreme leader, Khamenei, and they're unprepared to talk. And this, unfortunately, has been the history. When one side's ready, the other side's not. The only way to do this is to do what your previous guest just said, assertive diplomacy. You push it. You keep engaging. You look for the avenues to talk. The new report out from the IAEA has put new pressure on Iran. The sanctions have been put pressure. I expect the United States to launch new unilateral sanctions next week. All that is good. What you need to do is couple it with engagement. Talk to the Iranians the way we talked to the Soviets all during the Cold War. You can't shunt them aside. You can't ignore them. You have to engage in face-to-face diplomacy.
Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, a nuclear policy expert. We'll be back with him, with Ari Shavit, with Julian Borger, and also with Ash Jain, formerly with the State Department and now a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. First, we need to take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook later on, we'll talk about sexual abuse and football at Penn State University. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the UN International Atomic Energy Agency. It's an urgent concern about the possibility that Iran might be developing a nuclear weapon. It's renewed a controversy that's been going on, obviously, for a long time to come. We just heard Joe Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund say that diplomacy ought to be pursued. Earlier, we heard Ari Shavit say that this very development indicates a failure of international diplomacy. Ari Shavit, elaborate on that.
Well, I'll begin with what should be done now, and that will tell you about what was not done in the past. I think what must happen in the coming months, and this really might be the last winter of opportunity, is to have these crippling sanctions that everybody is talking about, but they were not implied yet. We're talking about basically two things. One, really hitting the Iranian financial system, and the other, hitting the import of processed oil to Iran, because ironically, Iran depends on processed oil for its economy, because it exports oil, but it needs the processed oil for its economy. Therefore, should the international community imply these sanctions in the coming months, this is the last opportunity to really threaten the regime by bringing the Iranian economy to a standstill. I will put it this way. Iran has an extremist mosque, but a very pragmatic bazaar. So far, the bazaar, the market, did not pay the real high price for having this dangerous project led by the extremist mosque. Should Iran be faced really with a dilemma, I think there is still a chance of the pragmatic Iran prevailing over the extremist Iran. The fact that the international community for a decade now, definitely in the last 5 or 6 years, did not act seriously. Many things were done in different levels. Some sanctions, some intelligence work, all kinds of things were done in recent years, but not with a real bite, not with real determination. So if the international community really acts seriously in the coming months, this will really be the assertive diplomacy that might save us from a really dangerous and possibly catastrophic scenario. I think that the fact that the Bush administration was preoccupied with Iraq rather than with Iran, the fact that the Obama administration, which did a lot of important work, but did not put this at the top of the list, and the fact that the Europeans, who again, Britain and France, get the picture and they're doing a lot, but they could not bring the rest of Europe along, and mainly we have the main problem with Russia and China. So I think that all these factors caused a situation where, although the challenge was really the most, I cannot overstate the importance of this challenge, again, not to Israel, but to the entire free world. And the experts throughout the world, in all the capitals, in Washington, London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, they understand this, and yet there was a failure in transforming this notion into a sense of immediacy, into mobilizing public opinion and creating political will to act. And this is what must be done now, because if it will not be done now, in a year's time, we might face dire consequences.
Joe Cirincione, back to you with the Plowshares Fund. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. And it's not because I disagree with the desire. I wish there was a way to impose some kind of crippling sanction that would force a state to do what we want. That has never happened. And that didn't happen with South Africa. It didn't happen with the Soviet Union. You can't do that. And you can't do it with Iran for this reason. If you bring the Iranian economy to a standstill, and what your guest is talking about is basically sanctioning the central bank of Iran, preventing them from doing financial transactions with the rest of the world, that means you stop the flow of 2.3 million barrels of oil a day coming out of Iran. You know what that does to the international economic system? It puts it into a tailspin. It kills jobs in Europe and in the United States. For that reason alone, the Western economies are not going to be in favor of that. But there's another consequence. It really ruins the lives of everyday Iranians. It would be a sanction that would cripple the lives of Iranians, not necessarily the government. The regime would be fine. It's the people that would suffer. The Iranian people are basically pro-American, anti-regime. Why would you want to change that dynamic? Don't turn the Iranian people against you. Instead, there are ways, and this is what you'll see next week, to do targeted sanctions, which have been effective, ones that are focused specifically on the nuclear program, on the missile program, on the Revolutionary Guard. These sanctions have been effective in drying up or constricting Iran's supply lines. They can't get the kinds of technology they need to advance their centrifuge program. They can't get the kind of technologies they need to advance their missile program. We're slowing things down, buying time. And while you're doing that, the kind of aggressive diplomacy I'm talking about, I see we define diplomacy a little differently, is that you have to find a way to engage Iran. You're not going to be able to get a grand bargain. There's not going to be some sit-down where Iran suddenly admits everything they did and says, what were we thinking? Let's make a deal. But there can be small deals you can make, for example, capping the Iranian enrichment of uranium. Right now, they're enriching it not just to 3% for fuel, but to 20% for fuel for a research reactor. That gets them very close to bomb-grade material. You want to make a deal that stops that, just caps that. There's been efforts to do that that have come close over the last 2 years, to keep exploring that. Second, we're withdrawing from Afghanistan. Iran helped us greatly in overthrowing the Taliban regime in 2005, 2002. We could use their help in stabilizing Afghanistan as we leave. We have mutual strategic interest there. We should be having talks with Iran on that, which might start creating some of the trust you need to get to a larger deal. Finally, I don't think Iran's going to get a bomb anytime soon. There is no sign whatsoever that they've made a decision to get a bomb. It would take them several years from a decision to actually build a bomb. I actually believe Iran is happy to get to the edge of a bomb, and we could continue in this state for some time to come. I don't think we're going to get to the Middle East apocalypse that your other guest describes.
Joe Cirincione with the Plowshares Fund. Ash Jain is formerly with the State Department, currently a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and it's good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
Do you think what Joe Cirincione is saying is sufficient, or that what Ari Shavit has advocated is the only way to go?
Well, I mean, frankly, I think that there is time to pursue both avenues. Diplomatic sanctions rounds of sanctions have been imposed over the years through four UN Security Council resolutions. So far, these kinds of sanctions targeting various sectors of Iran's economy have not succeeded in deterring Iran from pursuing its nuclear program. I don't think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic that further sanctions, whether they're broad or targeted, as your guests have suggested, would change Iran's determination to build a bomb. It may slow things down. There's evidence that it probably has had an impact in terms of setting back the time frame. But ultimately, I think Iran is determined enough, the regime is determined enough to proceed. And for that same reason, I don't think that engagement and diplomacy with the Iranian regime is likely to go very far. This was something the Obama administration came into office committed to trying to pursue, and it's reached out on several occasions, both quietly and publicly, to try to get the Iranian regime to come up with a way of talking and negotiating over its nuclear program, and that's gone nowhere. As Iran gets closer to that breakout capability that Joe mentioned, it's even more unlikely that Iran would then be ready to sit down and bargain away what I think it probably views as a great prize.
So what do we do?
Well, I certainly think that there's time to pursue all avenues. The hope that even by delaying Iran's nuclear program, perhaps something changes in Iran with the Green Movement, with the opposition to the regime that showed signs in over the last couple of years of being a significant new political force. So certainly the international community should focus on all efforts, diplomatic and targeted and other sanctions to try to slow things down and buy time. But ultimately, I'm afraid that I think the Obama administration and the U.S. Allies are going to be faced with a decision of either allowing Iran to break through and obtain a nuclear weapons capability or have to risk military action in order to prevent it.
Military action, even though, as we've heard from our other guests, it would have probably disastrous consequences in and of itself.
So absolutely. I mean, there are risks, consequences, and potential impacts, both military, economic, and strategic, that would result from having to employ a military force against Iran's nuclear facilities. But I do think it's important that those risks be weighed against the risks and consequences of allowing Iran to obtain a nuclear weapons capability. And those are quite significant. As one of your other guests pointed out, this regime in Iran is ideologically motivated. It may not be prepared to use a bomb in any kind of military attack. I think more likely it's seeking a bomb because it wants to deter any outside force from attacking its territory, and therefore create opportunities for it to take greater risks as it pursues its hegemonic goals in the Middle East, tries to dominate the region, and engage in the kind of subversion of democracies and support for terrorist groups like Hezbollah and Hamas that it hopes to use to end U.S. and Western interference in the Middle East and pursue a system that it would view as more in line with the Islamic Revolution in Iran.
Ash Jain, again, formerly with the State Department, now at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I want to go back to our first guest, Julian Borger, diplomatic correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. There have been reports that the United States has made inquiries of Britain as to whether it would be in any way supportive if, in fact, Israel were to attack Iran, if military action were to take place. So that the U.S., which would undoubtedly be drawn into that, would have an ally. Have you heard those reports?
That's right. Well, we printed one of them based on high-placed security sources in the U.K. that the inquiry had been made that looking forward, would the U.K. be on board if it was necessary to take military action? That's right.
What has Britain responded?
Basically, in the positive, the policy of this government, like the one before that, has been really on big foreign policy, military issues to go with the U.S. It was extremely controversial over Iraq, but from as far as we can tell, the U.K. is prepared to go down that same road again. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that plans are afoot. My sense was that this was contingency planning, and that one of the security, one of the scenarios that U.S. Senior U.S. Military officials fear is a conflict that is perhaps begun between Israel and Iran, that the U.S. is pulled into, either because Iran retaliates against both Israel and the U.S., or because there's a feeling that an attack by Israel that doesn't have the means of completely destroying the Iranian program would leave a kind of wounded bear, angry, vengeful, but with still the means to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program. And so there are various scenarios where things don't quite go according to plan, that containment breaks down, and there is a possibility of an unplanned conflict. And I think that's what the inquiries to the U.K. Ministry of Defense were about.
Ash Jain, back to you. Do you think that even though this is just a contingency planning and it would be an unplanned situation that they were talking about, would this the knowledge of this kind of planning have an impact on Iran?
Perhaps. I mean, I think the Iranians are always concerned about reports that an attack is coming. They have obviously planned for such potential attacks by investing heavily in trying to harden and locate facilities in places where they would be difficult for the United States or Israel, to find and penetrate them. So, to some extent, perhaps these kinds of reports get the Iranians focused again on what could be coming. But they probably know that as they near this threshold, there are going to be further discussions on what to do and whether to prevent it. And we're nearing a point where it's sort of a race to the finish, where the Iranians will try to seek maybe not an actual nuclear breakout, but as Joe suggested, reaching that point just below having a nuclear weapons capability, which in practical terms is the same thing, because if they can turn around a nuclear weapon within a matter of weeks or months, it provides the same military and psychological leverage, I think, that they're seeking in the region.
Julian Borger, earlier, Ari Shavit said it was not Netanyahu and Barak who had been speaking about the possibility of a nuclear attack, but that there had been leaks that there was discussion of this in the cabinet. What do you hear about what's going on in Israel?
Well, the message that I'm getting from Israeli officials, and they put it out quite strongly before the IAEA report came out, was, as Ari was saying, they see this as the last chance for a peaceful resolution to the Iranian nuclear crisis, meaning that if the international community doesn't get its act together as far as Iran is concerned, as Ari was suggesting, then Israel would be faced with a really serious dilemma and would have to make its own decisions based on its own, you know, very desperate national security needs.
So, Joe Cirincione, if Ari Shavit is correct and there are pragmatists and extremists in Iran, is the only hope that the pragmatists prevail?
Well, basically, yes. And this is one of the great things about foreign policy, that often buying time is a solution to your problems. Let me give you one quick example.
Quickly, because we're running short of time.
In the 1980s, Argentina and Brazil both had nuclear weapons programs. They were both racing to the bomb. We adopted sanctions that slowed those programs down and gave both the populations in Argentina and Brazil time to overthrow their military governments, create civilian governments that ended the bomb programs. Ultimately, that's what has to happen in Iran. You've got to have the people themselves making the regime change we all want, and realizing that Iran's security is better served without a nuclear weapon than with it. And we got to do everything we can to buy the time for those Iranian people to make that revolution happen.
Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, and we've just heard from Julian Borger, diplomatic correspondent for The Guardian in London, Ash Jain, formerly with the State Department, now at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Ari Shavit, a columnist for Haaretz in Jerusalem, writing a book about the Arab-Israeli conflict, to soon be published by Random House Publications. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Penn State's longtime assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky has been charged with sexually abusing 8 boys over a span of 15 years. 2 top university officials are charged with perjury and failing to tell authorities what they knew about that. And Joe Paterno, one of the most successful coaches in college football history, says he'll retire at the end of this year. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Werman Alnibach with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Hundreds of Penn State students gathered outside Joe Paterno's house last night chanting, "We love Joe." Paterno's son came out and suggested to them that they ought to have a moment of silence for the victims of sexual abuse, and they did that, too. It's unclear if Penn State University is going to even allow the 84-year-old icon, Paterno himself, to coach through the rest of this season. Michael Sansarino reports for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And, Michael, welcome to our program. I understand you're on the campus right now.
I am. Thanks for having me, Warren. I appreciate you having me on.
Sure enough. What's the mood there?
The mood here is a bit of confusion. People don't really know exactly what's going on with their university. Right now, it seems the most important thing that's happening is the Board of Trustees is trying to determine the fate of University President Graham Spanier. And once they get through that, I think Joe Paterno is the next person they'll take a look at. Joe has said today that he will retire at the end of the year, but it remains unclear if he'll be able to coach through this year.
The president of the university hasn't been charged, as have the senior vice president for finance and the athletic director. Is there any chance that he might be?
There's a chance that he might be charged. During a press conference on Monday, the attorney general here in Pennsylvania ruled out, essentially, Paterno as being charged in this case, but did not rule out Graham Spanier as being charged. What happened is everybody kind of went up the ladder with these allegations of sex abuse. It went all the way to Graham Spanier, who heard, but as he described it, there was horseplay between Jerry Sandusky and a young boy in a shower. And he determined at that point not to move forward with any type of criminal complaint, nor did Joe Paterno at the same time. So the state has said Joe Paterno has been a cooperating witness. They're not quite sure if Graham Spanier has been quite as cooperative.
Spanier says horseplay. How solid is the case of sexual abuse against Jerry Sandusky, as far as we know?
Seems to be very solid. And actually, in the past 24 hours, there have been more victims who, more or less victims, who have come forward with claims that he had sexually abused them. So there are eyewitness accounts, multiple eyewitness accounts, and then you also have firsthand accounts of victims, and in some cases, corroborating accounts of witnesses and family members. So it does not look good for Jerry Sandusky, who started a charity here in State College, Pennsylvania, and allegedly used the charity to find victims and lure them into his care and comfort.
These were not football players involved with this, but rather much younger children?
Yeah, much younger children who came from at-risk homes in Central and actually throughout the state of Pennsylvania. Jerry Sandusky would bring them in. He would take them to Penn State games. He would take them on campus and show them football practice, and then he and actually at times it would invite them over to his house, and when they would go to bed he would just prey on them. It's quite disturbing to read the grand jury presentment in the case against Jerry Sandusky, who actually retired from the university about 12 years ago.
I think our listeners may have seen some of those reports. We won't go into detail about them yet, or I should say on this program. But you mentioned eyewitness accounts. They included incidents in the shower room, is that correct, at the Penn State University football area?
That's correct. Yeah, there's a practice building on campus. And there was, at the time, a graduate assistant who is actually now an assistant coach on the team. His name is Mike McCleary, who was returning sneakers to his locker late at night, saw the showers on, and witnessed Mr. Sandusky in the shower with a boy, sexually abusing that young boy. And he was distraught, talked to his father, and then he eventually started this chain of events where he told Coach Paterno. Paterno told his superiors, the athletic director and the vice president of finance. They passed up the ladder to Graham Spanier, and ultimately no one decided at any point that they should tell the police. And we're talking, this was 9 years ago. And in that time, allegedly, Jerry Sandusky has abused more boys. And I think that's where most of the outrage, both on and off campus, comes from.
And the commissioner of the state police has said that Paterno had a moral requirement to do more than he did, even though it may be that he acted according to the law itself. Why did it take so long, do you think, to get to this point? Does it have something to do with the fact that Penn State football is a revered institution, and that Joe Paterno himself has advanced that situation enormously?
Absolutely. Joe Paterno is an icon, and Penn State is a national brand that pulls in millions of dollars each year. This is an athletic department that pulls in more than $100 million annually. And any type of allegation that would come out would hurt both Joe Paterno's image, which at this, at least up until this week, was one of the most revered in the country, and it also hurt the financial bottom line of this university and the athletic department.
And Jerry Sandusky, while he was there, was an extremely successful coach, was he not?
He was. He was the defensive coordinator for more than two decades and really developed a reputation as being one of the top defensive minds in the game. The Penn State has often been called linebacker U because of the successful pro careers of their linebackers, and Jerry Sandusky was the mentor for many of them for years. So he was respected as a football mind, but really he was respected as a community leader because of his work with that charity.
What is this liable to do to the football program at Penn State?
Well, if history is any guide, and certainly this case is far different from any type of scandal that schools have been involved in. But most schools who have NCAA infractions or even some legal issues, it takes a long time for them to recover from whatever punishment is handed out. Now, the NCAA has not yet said if they'll penalize Penn State. They're going to wait for these legal actions to take forth. But there's certainly a negative stigma surrounding this program. It does not appear Joe Paterno will end his career on his terms, and I don't think he's in a position to dictate when his career will end at this point. And we've seen many cases where coaches who have been in an institution for a long time, who have garnered a lot of support, leave under difficult circumstances, and the program suffers. Indiana basketball is one that you can look at when Bobby Knight was fired in 2000. It's taken several years for that school and that program to build its reputation back up, and really it's still not there.
And in the meantime, you said alleged victims are coming forward. How many so far?
Well, there the state confirmed that there was a ninth victim that came forward. There have been some reports that put the number closer to 20. But as I'm sure you're well aware, in instances of sexual abuse, oftentimes victims don't report crimes for fear of backlash, for fear of guilt, for fear of whatever. So it could be a number far greater than 20.
And when you talk about kids who are in at-risk homes, you're talking about people who very likely don't see reporting to the police as something that is available to them. Let's put it that way. Thanks a lot for being on our program. Michael Sansereno, again, a sports reporter at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Good to have you with us. Today's program produced by Caitlin Schamberg with Christian Bordahl and Anna Scott. Our technical director is Phil Richards. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/To The Point. You can join the conversation on To The Point's Facebook page. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.